John's gospel moves quickly. In the first chapter, he's already gathered together his new disciples. He knows their names before he's even met them. And some of them he even names anew when he meets them. And just after that, in chapter 2, we as new disciples experience the miracle of water turned to wine at the wedding feast of Cana. And then suddenly, still just in chapter 2, we are following Jesus up into the Temple Mount. But as Jesus enters the courtyard, we find that he's begun to do something strange. He's binding some ropes together. He's actually begun yelling. He's tipping over tables and driving people out. And suddenly, we're starting to feel a little unsettled about following this country rabbi into the temple of Jerusalem. If you're feeling awkward about Jesus' foolish words and teachings for the second time in 2 weeks, then you've been paying attention well. But whereas last week Jesus was teaching us uncomfortable lessons about the long path of discipleship, today I think he's teaching something about moments of choice in the pursuit of God. What's confusing is that all these tables that Jesus is turning over and all of these money changers that he's driving out are necessary for the function of the temple as we've known it. We can't pay the temple tax with the money of our Roman oppressors. We need to change it so that we can provide a holy offering. And we need an unblemished animal to sacrifice. So it's really better to buy one here than to schlep one from home in the heat and the dust. Based on the way we've always done things, the system of the temple seems like a faithful pursuit of God. But as the dust settles from the quick exit of the changers and of the sellers, Jesus is left with the leaders of the temple and with us still standing by. If we listen carefully at this moment, we'll recognize something very faithful in the words of the temple authorities as they ask of Jesus, "What sign can you give us for doing this?" That is, by what authority are you doing this? They do not ask petulantly, "Why?" as though there could be a rational explanation for these behaviors. But recognizing the work of a prophet, they ask for a sign to prove that this is a work of faithfulness before God. Now, this really catches me off guard because there's nothing easy or comfortable about the openness, the reluctant, maybe even worried openness, but openness nonetheless that the temple authorities are showing here. The temple authorities are the experts of their time on worship of the God of Israel. And if anyone knows how things should be in this temple, it's them. And yet, they respect their own need for growth and give Jesus just a hint of space. Imagine a stranger or even a friend comes into your home or the place where you practice your vocation and says, "Now, you know, you really need to change." This is not an easy thing for any of us to hear. Even if they're not carrying a whip, it can seem pretty offensive. But sometimes we can hear there's a possibility they may be right. In my experience, maintaining openness in a moment like this is completely unsettling. And maybe you know that feeling. My experience of it that stands out is being back working in St. James Church in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The parish is historically multicultural, with late immigrants from Northern Europe and more recent immigrants from the predominantly Black Anglican churches of the Caribbean, and just now students and employees from the local universities. And while I was there, they brought together for the first time an anti-oppression team to look reflectively at how the differences of race and ethnicity among them were both giving them new life and challenging them as a community. Having grown up white in mostly white New Hampshire, a lot of that conversation was new to me. I was present to the preliminary discussions and the careful collective decision to undertake the work, and the selection of a framework and facilitators for entering in, and I began to get excited seeing the process. I could tell it was aimed towards the flourishing of the kingdom of God. And then came this moment in a small 9x9 office with two desks packed in when my friend and then supervisor, the Reverend Edwin Johnson, said to me, "Reed, we'd really like you to be a part of the anti-oppression team if you're willing." At that moment, I could feel with my gut what I'd only thought about with my head before, this actual challenge of the work that the anti-oppression team was undertaking. I could feel this uncomfortable churning about the offer that was in front of me. And I couldn't ask Edwin why. I couldn't ask what will happen if I say yes, or what will we become together through this. Because the work of the anti-oppression team was a step into the unknown. We hadn't lived that way before together. What I did know beyond a doubt, right down where the question had lodged in my belly, was that the question was asked with holy authority. Being a part of that team would expose me to new truths, which would leave me only two options: be transformed in relation to God and my neighbor, or deny God and my neighbor in order to maintain the ways of being in which I had lived. Hence the tightness. Certainly, I didn't want to deny God's hope for me, but neither was I really that excited about the challenge of transformation. Transformation hurts. It exposes the foolishness of the worldly wisdom that we have followed, and it requires us to leave a part of ourselves, a way of being, behind. Not only that, but following forward from these little deaths, all that's in front of us is the bright foolishness of God. This moment of tightness is where we find Jesus back in the temple court, responding with characteristically confusing words to the hesitant and maybe terrified openness of the temple leaders. He says, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." That's his sign. Not only are the temple authorities left confused, but we, the disciples gathered, are also. Jesus seems to have been working moments ago for the honor of the temple, and now he's talking about destroying it. Well, thanks to John's fluid, playful sense of time in this gospel, disciples today get to read the answer right away. Jesus is speaking now of his own forthcoming death and resurrection. The worship of God, so long centered in Jerusalem, is about to be broken open and shared far and wide. John's gospel goes on to expand this message. Jesus is teaching that by his death and resurrection, we ourselves will become the temple of God's Spirit, worshiping in spirit and truth in all times and places. And so Jesus offers this metaphor of temple, knowing that he embodies this new covenant of God, a covenant defined by trust and vulnerability, which leads to the cross, and by the grace and power of God in the resurrection. Now, as playful as John and Jesus are with time and narrative, we today need to practice a sense of double vision as we experience this story. Yes, we know how the story ends, but we also know the feeling in the temple courts that day, with tables turned over and the sweat on Jesus' brow and animals milling about aimlessly. This moment when even the disciples, who have already recognized Jesus as the Messiah, even those closest to him still can't see the new thing that he's up to. Like those people at the temple that day, or the people that Jesus will talk to from Samaria, or even the Romans who will hear his words, sometimes we too have to hold out for the fullness of Jesus' teaching. Some, even one of the 12 apostles of Jesus, couldn't hold out and pass through the cross with him. It's a challenging road to walk. Knowing the whole story does not exempt us from moments of confused or terrified openness in our own discipleship. I've come to recognize them when my belly clenches up and my spirit hides, maybe from the invitation that's around the next corner in my life. Maybe I'm hiding from the pull to offer an apology. Maybe I'm hiding from the pull to offer forgiveness. But we can face such moments through the double vision of Lent, seeing with one eye the lonely road to the cross, and with the other, the sun rising over the empty tomb of Easter. While they followed Jesus in life, his original disciples knew he was the Messiah. Those who followed him through his death and resurrection learned how he was the Messiah. We hold this confusing, renewing tension for 40 days each year so that we can practice for those moments of choice and know that feeling drawing us forward. As I accepted that distinctive feeling and joined the St. James anti-oppression team, I entered a fruitful adventure full of wonder and of challenge. I left behind some painful illusions about whiteness, and I learned how to walk more closely with my Black sisters and brothers, especially through the friendship of Edwin. If you're interested, I'd love to share more about that. I know that I have more to learn if I am willing. Now, where is God calling you to deeper openness and fullness? Where do you feel the pull this Lent? If you know the next step, take courage. Christ is with you. Step forward. And if you're still listening for that voice of foolish wisdom, keep silence. Open your ears. Open your heart. The Lord calls each of us by name.